Hey, welcome to the Happy Rant Podcast. I am Ted Kluck, joined as always in studio by my good friends, my partners in radio, Barnabas Piper and Ron Martin. Boys, we got interesting things to discuss today, but before we do it, baby, you're back, right? You're off the road. Pipe and I had to handle one without you. Where were you last week? Anywhere amazing?
Yeah, I know that. I know. God, boys, apologies for that. But yeah, it's back out on the road. I was in a beautiful Hilton Head, South Carolina for a few days working with the network. Wow. And I mean, before you get too jealous, it was 40 degrees, raining. We were in a big resort hotel, so we didn't really get to... We didn't really get to have the experience that I've become accustomed to, as we all like to say.
You guys are getting closer to putting the harbor in Harbor Network, however.
Yeah. Well, we put it – I mean, everything's a nautical theme. So we are – anytime we can get sort of something, aligned with, saying words like anchor and those types of things, we do it. So.
You know, Paul suffered in his ministry travels too, and
He did, and he was even shipwrecked.
Yeah, I mean, being
at a harbor,
being 40 degrees and stuck in a big, beautiful resort—that's akin, probably, to what he went through.
Guys, I don't want you to. I mean, don't. I don't. You know, don't feel bad for me.
Okay.
You know, I don't. You okay. Guys, it's done. Okay. I'm gonna be okay. Okay. I'm gonna be all right.
I'm gonna have KK scratch it off the prayer list then. I'll text my small group and have them stop praying.
Yeah, I appreciate that. I mean, I still appreciate the prayers, but, just for that other stuff we talked about off.
Yeah, all that personal stuff we talk about.
All the unspoken prayers we discuss.
Piper, if our listeners want to hear and read more about the Apostle Paul and his journeys and his writings, tell them how they can do that via Dwell Bible.
Oh, I'm just sorry. I was floored by your spectacular segue there. That was
what a transition.
I do a little radio, boys.
We're
going to be doing more radio, old school radio, as it turns out. But Piper, tell them about Dwell Bible.
Yes, listeners, if you go to the website dwellapp.io/happyrant, you can be introduced to Dwell Bible app, or you can just search for it in your app store. But you do have, there's a subscription. That website is where you can find our listener discount. It is an audio Bible app. It has kind of every feature you would want when it comes to audio Bible engagement, multiple narrators, multiple Bible versions, listening plans to get you through the Bible in a year, or to go through the Bible thematically or chronologically, or to focus on they have lists, promise lists or benediction lists or different things to just sort of feed you different aspects of scripture. They have a read along option, which kind of functions like a karaoke screen where it just scrolls as you listen. And then they just have an actual Bible you can read. So if you want to kind of alternate between listening and reading, but just have a more standard reading experience, that's built in as well. They're constantly developing new features and new playlists and new listening plans and building it out for with more and more options. So again, go to dwellapp.io/happyrant. They offer a 30% discount off a lifetime subscription for our listeners and a 10% discount off of annual. All that is totally worth it. You can also give it as a gift if it's something you think somebody else in your life would benefit from. If you've been talking to somebody who's frustrated at their lack of time in the Word, and this could be a way to kind of create an on-ramp for that. Buy it for them, give it as a gift. Go check it out.
Love it. Good work, Pipe. And we love Dwell Bible as a company and as individuals. It's a great product. So we've got three topics to talk about, two of which are actually interesting, and one of it which is just kind of quirky. But I want to start with one of the interesting ones. And Pipe, I'm going to read what you texted us and ask you to explain it as a kind of on-ramp into the discussion. So you said this: I kind of find the current complementarian / egalitarian debate funny because it is the exact same one as the one in the 80s. Explain this to me. I don't remember the one in the 80s, and I don't know like really the ins and outs of the one now. Like I know the difference.
You weren't paying attention to this when you were like 13 years old and riding your Huffy bicycle to the movie theater to watch Indiana Jones or whatever.
Nice.
On the Huffy.
I love that you got the Huffy.
I love that. Nice. No free shout out.
Great touch, pipe.
But Huffy, if you're still a company and are still out there.
You could have said Murray too. I mean, that would have been equally as legit because those were the two brands you could get at like Zodi's or whatever like department store they had back in that day.
I'm just shocked that neither of you were paying close attention to the egalitarian complementarian debate during that era of your life.
Dude, no,
I, however, was paying attention at 4 years old. So
it's all we talked about at my Christian school was, it's literally, I mean, in between like memorizing scripture and, you know, like whether like drinking was a sin, it was all we talked about.
It's all we talked about at my public school. In between, like, you know,
it's all my parents talked to me about
exactly
after they read me
family
my
devotionals. That's
all the boys, all the boys in your Christian school were just deciding they didn't need to listen to the female teachers. She can't teach me
100%. I mean, every night before dinner, Dad would say, "Now let's just recap what we think about egalitarianism." I mean, it was just standard every
those
day.
Are sweet memories, aren't they, baby?
Oh, they're so sweet.
Sweet. No, Pipe, seriously, like, sketch out the current debate and the one in the 80s and talk about how they're similar. And then Rommel and I can contribute.
I mean, obviously, the large scope of the debate is what does the Bible have to say about the roles of men and women in the church? And then some people expand that to the home and broader society. And you know, what are the explicit commands, what's et cetera? And so the debate in the 80s had to do with, I mean, it turned into a debate about inerrancy. You know, so if you take a different stance than me on this, you don't believe in the inerrancy of Scripture because Scripture says X, you believe Y. Clearly, you don't believe in the inerrancy. So it basically turned from a debate about interpretation to a debate about, are you a Christian? You know, believe that the Word of God is inerrant, which is pretty foundational to the faith. Yeah. Well, we have re-entered the exact same debate, this time with all of the tact and politeness and gentleness that Twitter brings to the table, as opposed to scholarly papers and academic publishers. So,
and isn't that great?
Well, that's
we're so glad that it just got to Twitter.
We've really leveled up as a society.
So much better.
Yeah, I'm overall greatly encouraged by the tone of the debate these days. It's so civil, it's so kind. Everybody clearly wants to listen and love one another. But I think it's hilarious because there's significant books on both sides of the issue written by, you know, really pretty good scholars in the 80s and early 90s. My dad and Wayne Grudem wrote the one on complementarianism. There are books on the other side, you know, about this. But the debate tended to stay in the realm of interpretation, not like accusation of heresy.
Sure.
Which is where we've gone to now. So accusations of heresy, if you are open to a more broad understanding of complementarianism, you know, not applying it to the home, not applying it to, you know, the broader society, etc. And I find it funny because making secondary issues into issues of heresy is either the worst thing in the world or something we laugh at.
Mm-hmm.
And it's funny because we've done this already, or our parents did this. And, you know, I don't know where the phrase came from, but those who don't know history are doomed to repeat it. And here we are. We are repeating the exact same debate, except with all of like the base expressions and 280 character limits that we have that we have placed on ourselves now.
Okay, yeah, it's good you mentioned that because I want to kind of like talk about the pathology of like discourse on Twitter and how that changes the conversation. And I'll ask this to Ronald because he's been known to spend a minute or two on Twitter. Do you think this is a thing again because it's just marketable? You know what I mean? In the way that Twitter has kind of rewired people to find those topics which are inherently like marketable, and things are marketable typically because they're shot through with like conflict. You know what I mean? It's what powers a story. So I wonder if this thing keeps coming around because the people with audiences keep bringing it around because it's inherently marketable. And I think a follow-up question to that would be, do you think that even happens on a conscious level, or is it just subconscious? Do you know what I'm asking? Does that make sense, baby?
Yeah. Like what do you, what, I don't know what you mean by marketable. Like, cause I think these are just like, these are almost just, this is like very like in-house debatey. So it's, nobody's necessarily benefiting from it on any level other than to establish a point that they seem very passionate about and that they want to take from, like what Piper just said, from what we would say is a second or third tier level and just make it primary, you know?
Yeah, so I guess what I was asking is, like, I think Twitter has rewired people such that it's not even about the debate as much as it's about just getting looked at. You know what I mean?
So it's about, like, the response.
No, that makes sense.
Yeah. So
that's fair. That's fair.
This is a sports thing, but maybe you heard about it, baby. Like, there's this guy, Antonio Brown, who got into a conflict with his coach like 3 weeks ago and like started essentially taking his clothes off on the field, like his uniform. And, you know, and he walked off the field wearing like only his pants. And it became, of course, this huge social media thing. And the point of it was not even so much what was the argument with his coach about, as much as it was about him getting looked at and then people using it, you know what I mean, to get themselves looked at. And I wonder if that's not sort of the motivation behind this debate. Because at the end of the day, people just believe what they believe about it, and they probably have decent reasons for believing it. And yet, you know, we're using all this time talking about it.
Well, I think it's interesting because I think what you're saying is true. Yeah. So what I think is happening is, I think it either can, like, there are certain people that use it for that. So they want to say something that's going to be, they want to say something that is going to cause, you know, a Twitter war. Yeah. And what it does is, whether anybody agrees with them or not, all it's doing is increasing their platform in the sense that now everybody's talking about them. So, you know, bad press is good press.
Sure.
And the whole point is, you know, they're sticking to their guns in terms of what they believe about this particular topic. What's interesting about it, though, is, like, if you take it to the next step, for people that are sort of like standing on the edge and they're looking in, I'll just say, like, me and Piper, you know, who are not like getting into that debate necessarily.
Yeah.
But for us
Ronnie, did you not like?
Well, I meant beside you, but
resting on my.
But for us to stand back and like look in and just go, okay, you know, I'm just reading, I'm just listening, I'm just learning. It does this other weird thing where, like, I actually know where others, you know, where other people's opinions now exist, you know, in this debate. Whereas before, I wouldn't have even known that. And not only that, but I know how passionate they are about it. And not only that, I know how angry they are about it. And not only that, I know how they react when something comes up that people disagree with them about. And, you know, so now I know something about a person's character. I know about their, you know, how they respond and their reaction time with these things. Like, these are all things now that have, like, surfaced people's character and make them come to light in a way that makes me look at them and go, well, that's weird. Like, I wouldn't have even known that about this person. And now it's almost like it unleashed this monster.
Yeah.
Because they didn't have the self-control or the whatever to sort of pull back and lean back and go, hey, I can just be cool. I don't have to let everything go when it comes to my opinion on this topic. So that's what's so crazy. So the initial guy gets all the platforming from it. Mm-hmm. And then now everybody else gets to see how other people now react to topics that we think are second and third tier, and, you know, how much they lose their cool when they're in a conversation where people disagree with them. So, like, the whole thing just falls apart, which is really interesting to me.
No,
it just totally collapses.
Yeah, it is fascinating. So I guess, and I'll frame this as a question to Piper, but you guys can both answer it, and I would like to hear you on it too, baby. Is your life better for knowing everybody's take on it? You know what I mean? Like, as you look at your life and you look at this debate as like a little sliver of your life, now that you know, I mean, 25 years ago, you might have known what 6 people think about complementarianism. And now you know what 600 people think about it. Is that a like a value added or the opposite pipe? What do you think?
I think it's utterly, well, if you can, you know, refrain from judging people accordingly, like, oh, I didn't know that they were so passionately on whatever side of this issue, and then you judge them. If you can refrain from that, it's basically a neutral, because what is most revelatory about this to me is how out of touch Twitter is with how people live their lives.
Oh, expand on that. That's fascinating.
You get into, I mean, it's true in every angry debate on Twitter. If you go from, you know, you spend an hour just threading and going back and forth with people and whatever, and then you go and meet with your small group at church or like play golf with guys or A, 90% of those people have no idea what you're talking about if you bring this stuff up.
Yeah.
If you approach them with the same passion you go on Twitter, they're like, whoa, 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 you know.
Calm down.
Take a pill and settle down.
You're a
down.
Maniac. Yeah, relax.
Yeah, yeah. Exactly.
And it's just like people in everyday life are like, you know what I can't do? I can't get my three-year-old to stay in their big kid bed. We just moved him from a crib, and I'm losing sleep, and I'm tearing my hair out. And I want to, you know. So there's just this massive disconnect, I think it's a neutral in terms of how you view other people. I think the biggest negative for me is that it feels like it takes my eye off the ball. You know, so
sure
it makes me want to weigh in on things that life would be a lot better if I didn't.
Yeah, that makes sense.
I don't benefit at all by giving my two cents, letting people know where I stand. Even though the fact is I share a last name with the guy who wrote the most complimentarian book.
Yeah.
Which means that the general assumption, especially by people who disagree with him, is that I am exactly like he is. Mm-hmm. Usually, you know, that comes with a fair amount of dislike or mistrust. Mm-hmm. Okay. I'd rather let them believe that than try to nuance a take or come back at them or even have a civil discussion about it, because I just, whatever.
Yeah.
The only time I want to talk about this is if somebody approaches me at church and says, hey, where does Emmanuel stand on this? And we can have a kind, respectful human conversation where they can ask follow-up questions. I can give nuances. I can shrug my shoulders at some point and go, honestly, like this is as far as we go with it. Not, you know, we're not fighting over this with anybody. And I'm fine with that conversation.
Yeah.
Everything else is like, okay. But the other interesting parallel with the 80s is in the 80s, this mostly lived at the high theological level.
Mm-hmm.
It was seminarians, academics, people who wanted to read 500-page books, which is basically like what Twitter is now. It's this tiny portion of the population who wades into a battle. It's just, you know, except it's like junkyard dogs fighting instead of academics debating. But it's the same kind of, it's the same influence on society and the same like kind of percentage of the population, if you will.
Yeah.
That's a great point, Pipe. I mean, yeah, like these discussions would have happened like in an academic level, right? The evangelical theological society, it would have all been like that, you know, it wasn't coming down to, you know, sort of the level of the layperson. And I think that's where, that's where it's attempting to exist. And
it's still not lay people having the conversation by and large.
It's though, not, is it? You're right.
So
no, you're right.
I have a comment about Twitter and then a question.
Don't you miss it, Ted?
just aching
daily,
you know.
Yeah,
my comment though is I think we've got maximum about another decade with it, and I say that because my students Twitter's not even remotely a part of their world. They don't care about it, they don't use it, they don't talk about it, they don't think about it. And that's been true.
They're on TikTok.
Yeah, that's been true for at least the last 5 or 6 years. The only people I really know who use Twitter are like 35 to 55 year old men. And you know,
or those strongly influenced by 35 to 55, 65 years. So like you'll get a lot of young theology bros on there.
Sure.
On the other side, in another camp, the young activistic types, you know.
Oh, sure, yeah.
Mid-20s, dealing in issues of race or gender or whatever, but it's almost always passionate tribal stuff, not normal soccer mom or average teenager or, you know, college sophomore who's, you know, trying to figure out if they want to be a literature or a business major.
Yeah, no.
But that was the way it was always going to be, though, right? I mean, so like, because we have social media platforms, it means that none of them are going to exist in the same spot, you know, in terms of culturally or with like it trending forever, right? Like Facebook is for grandpas, you know, basically.
Yeah, so it's like drunk uncle of social media.
Yeah, I mean, and it's like, and so it doesn't mean that they're going to be obliterated or they're just going to disappear, although they could. I mean, MySpace is a great example of that. So yeah, in 10 years, yeah, there might not be a Twitter. Chances are there will be, but there's going to be three more platforms that we don't even know about that are being established right now that the next generation is going to be plugged into.
Yeah.
So it's interesting how that... I mean, we're gonna see a timeline with all of these things.
So here's my question about Twitter vis-a-vis this debate about complementarianism. But you could plug in literally any other debate, and it still works. What were these guys doing? Like these guys who are having these debates, like literally, how were they spending their time a decade and a half ago before there was Twitter? Like if all the like time resources.
What did we do?
What did you do?
What is to do?
Like, actually, it's a serious question wrapped in a funny question, and we could definitely go haha with it, or we could go serious with it. But like, what were pastors doing a decade and a half ago before there was sort of the option to, you know, be a keyboard warrior on Twitter all the livelong day? Like, I would love to know. It's what was happening? I don't know. Somebody explain this to me.
I'm stumped.
How did people live?
Well, so
what did they do?
I mean, so let's, I'll use myself as an example. That way I can say mean things and not hurt anybody else's feelings.
Sure.
So when I was in college, I went to Wheaton and, you know, I came out of a staunchly complementarian background, and The Council for Biblical Manhood and Womanhood was kind of doing chapters at colleges at that point. And so I got involved in that. And, you know, it's super tiny.
Sure.
But it was stuff like that. That's what the Twitter warrior were doing. So I was of the young theology bro is probably fair, you know, kind of cage stage Calvinist-y type of guy at 20. And influenced by the 45, 55-year-old theologians who had – you know, whether or not you agree with him, they at least put careful thought into things. And so I was influenced by that, not putting careful thought into things, just taking their conclusions and waging war over them. And so I think it went that way, where you gather a group of passionate people around you and you shout in agreement at one another. Aren't all those egalitarians idiots, for example?
Yeah.
You know, how can they read their Bible and think this? That type of thing. And then occasionally you turn outward and have debates with, you know, the people you think are just heinously liberal on campus, and when in reality they're just slightly more egalitarian than you are, and you think like, how dumb are these people? And it's all small scale. So, you know, relationships are damaged and egos are boosted and criticisms are made and, you know, a lot of mean things are said.
Yeah,
but amongst like 20 people. Instead of saying it in a way that can then get hijacked and captured and spread to hundreds or thousands of people in an impersonal way. And I mean that, and I think people who were sort of the warrior mentality, like I'm going to pick a fight over this stuff. They just did that. They found like-minded people.
Yeah.
And they were sort of like theological, like they built little kind of theological communes in their minds, you know? Like the weirdo Idaho separatists who are like, they have guns and they're waiting for the government to come take them and it's going to be another Ruby Ridge or whatever. It's like a super low key version of that. We're just waiting for the egalitarians to come for our church. They're coming. We're ready. We're ready for them when this war over the church comes, that kind of thing. Except it was tiny, it was separate, and the battle never came.
I think too, Pipe, like you said something a minute ago that I think is so important. I mean, to get serious here for like 1 second, which is like, you know, like I'm in my community group last night. There's 15 of us. I mean, if I were to say hey guys, here's a fun word for you to discuss for 4 minutes, complementarianism. I mean, they would look at me like I had lost my mind because none
which
of them
is good, right? Like,
which is good. Yeah. None of them would be able to articulate it.
Right.
A couple of them might just go, is that the thing where like we only have male elders at our church? And I would say, yeah. Okay, so what do you want to know?
Yeah.
Like, or, huh? You know, like there would be this sense of like, that's a theological word. Ronnie, that's something that you're supposed to know about that, I mean, I don't really feel like we should know about or need to know about, or you will instruct us when you feel like we need to know about this, or that's probably something we learned in our membership class 8 years ago that nobody remembered, you know, 24 seconds after you led us through it. And so there is something that there's an out of touchness with some of these things where you go at the end of the day, like Piper was saying, man, this gets me off my marks, mm-hmm. right? My marks are to like get in the trenches with my people and, you know, walk alongside of them through the things that they are battling and dealing with every day. And this, although I, you know, everything's important in its own lane. I mean, this would not be something that, you know, we would want to put at that level in terms of, hey, how are we helping our people become more like Jesus and love Jesus more? I mean, you know, complementarianism is not something that I would say necessarily fits in that. Right?
Also, I don't think this is a lane. Like this is a demolition derby, you know, like if the debate stayed in its lane. Okay. But this is just like chaos. It's just insane. You know, anybody's invited. Like, do you have a vehicle to move? Sure. Come run into other people. This sounds fun. That's sort of the tone of it. It's bonkers.
I think,
okay, so here's a thought experiment. I think one good way to see is this helpful or is this insane, mm-hmm. is to take a debate such as this one, bring it to your community group and present it, or at least think through how would they, like what Ronnie just said is exactly right. If you think, how would this land if I took it to my friends who I love, who I spend the bulk of my kind of life with, and I said, hey, let me read you a couple tweets, and they look at you like, you have lost your ever-loving mind. Well, there you go. That's probably the level. That's probably the tipping point between right. helpfulness and insanity.
Yeah, no, that's a good word. I mean, I think Twitter really works as a piece of entertainment for a person who likes to be entertained in a certain type of way, which isn't all people. But if we look at it as entertainment primarily, then it probably works okay.
I think so.
But if we, yeah.
And information too, information, I gain information from Twitter. I learn things that I just didn't know.
Yeah. And I guess you're always weighing the, like, you know? Is the information that I'm gleaning worth the like pain that I have to go through to get it, you know? And that answer is going to be different for every person. Right.
Absolutely.
And also the level of entertainment you get from it is going to be different for every person.
It is personality driven though, too. I mean, that's a great point because, you know, like me and Big M, you know, we will read, let's just say, for example, we read the same three, like, you know, Twitter debates mm-hmm. on a day. I'm out. I just happen to see him. She's doing her own thing. We happen to see him. We get home and she's like, I'm so mad because so-and-so said this, so-and-so said that, so-and-so said this. And I just kind of go, oh, right. Yeah, I saw that. Mm-hmm. And she's like, you just don't even seem like you care. And I'm like, I kind of don't. I just like, I get it. Like, I hate, like, I would agree with everything she would say in terms of what was true about it, what was inflammatory about it, what we disagreed with. But like, at the end of the day, it's not like, it's not upsetting me.
Yeah.
I'm not going to lose sleep over it.
Yeah.
I don't feel like, oh no, the justice needs to be done now, you know? So that is that's just a personality thing between the two of us.
Well, and not to like force you to be the ultimate complementarian and speak for your wife, but like, would she say that her life is better for having gotten angry over it? You know what I mean?
Well, you know what? Yeah. So let me answer that question like this first. How dare you accuse me? No, I'm kidding.
I mean, how dare me just in general? That's a blanket. How dare you? And I'll
it's a blanket. I mean, I like blanket. How dare yous. They're
of
fun.
Course.
Yeah, no. I mean, Big M, I mean, that would be a thing where I would just be like, hey, I get it. But I mean, like, why so angry? We don't need to, like, who cares?
Right.
Like, this is not changing our lives. This is not affecting our lives. We got to go visit somebody tonight who is hurting and like really needs us to sit there not talking to them about complementarianism.
Yeah. No, and that's good, right? And the people who do the vast majority of that are probably the healthiest people, right? Like, so if your life is really grounded in the local church and interfacing with actual people in your actual life, that's probably healthy. And it probably to some degree informs how you would interact then on Twitter. Piper, I want to ask you a question about something that you mentioned the last time you talked. You used a term, theo bros or theological bros. And yes, this is a term that I've heard or kind of bandied about over the last like 9 to 12 months. And yes, like functionally it kind of operates, I think, in the following way, but I want to ask you about it. Theo bro is basically just anyone who disagrees with me about anything having to do with theology. That's how I hear it used. And it's always accompanied by like a sniff or an eye roll or whatever. But my question is, are there any good ones? Like, are there any good Theo bros? Is it always a pejorative?
I think
this
the term
is just a semantic question.
I think the term is entirely negative. It is so. It's not just a disagreement. It's like it's sort of a demographic.
Yeah,
you know, it's. If you said seminarian, Ted,
yeah,
there would be like 80% overlap in this Venn diagram. It is. Yeah. It's so like a theologically passionate, and malformed younger man. You know, so okay, I'd say generally under 35, but probably under 30.
Got it.
Who has the piranha mentality.
Okay.
Swarm to blood in the water and devour the take that you disagree with.
Uh-huh.
There's a lot of well actually. There's a general tone deafness. There's also just a general deafness. Not a lot of listening going on amongst the Theo bro crowd. Profound confidence in their own opinions. You know, and so you can pull like there's pastors, there's seminarians, there's some of, you know, kind of nerd, you know, academic nerd Twitter would be in here, but also just like theological hobbyists who want to go pick a fight and that kind of thing. So it's entirely
emotional
pejorative.
EQ levels at like zero, basically, you know?
Okay. So I have another question about Theo bros. This is good. I'm learning a lot here. Are Theo bros always conservative or are there like liberal Theo bros?
Great question.
The way that I've seen it used is it always refers to the theologically and then you know, generally politically conservative. The other side gets called things like social justice warriors.
That's
libtards. It's because it's the people who don't like them who's giving them the name, and so the name has to sort of negatively reflect how you perceive them.
Yeah.
So theological frat boys, essentially, or you know, overwrought, overpassionate, left-leaning, you know, pinko commie types, you know, if we're gonna insult everybody.
No, dude, that's super helpful. That's actually super, super helpful to me.
Is there a more dated but greater phrase than pinko commie? I mean, in our lives,
I remember like
my dad used that approximately 7 times a day.
Yes, dude.
To describe somebody that he didn't like. John F. Martin, man, I feel like he coined that phrase almost. It was like he adopted that phrase somehow. It was like when somebody asked me who invented that phrase, I would say, I think it was my dad, you know, at some point.
I can't bring myself to say the phrase theological Marxist, or I'm sorry, cultural Marxist. I can't, like,
I know, I'm
I,
with
see,
you,
I can't even say
but
it
I love
I
it so much. That's, it's like, let's bring back some of those Cold War phrases,
I just,
man.
Aren't we basically doing that? Like, yes.
Yeah.
It's a big standoff between two sides, neither of whom will ever actually take a swing at the other. So it's the Cold War.
Yeah, but nobody's saying, I'm just saying like for fun, nobody's saying pinko commie anymore. I mean, they're saying cultural Marxist, but nobody's saying, let's go old school with it is what I'm saying. I want to just start using the old school terms.
Dude, see if you can bring that back. I mean,
I'd love to bring it back.
Bring it back. Hey, I have a man, I'm sorry. I'm not like getting to any of the things that we said that we would talk about.
Oh, this is
today.
So much better than what we had lined up. Just keep
going. Yeah. So I have a question for you, baby, about your dad, who I know has passed. But if he were still alive, like what would his relationship be with Twitter and with like this kind of stuff? Because I feel like in the 80s, our dads got the majority of whatever itch that it is that Twitter scratches. Like, I want to see the debate. I want to be outraged. I want to feel better about myself. I want to get my own values reassured, and be entertained. So if those are all the kind of like Twitter touch points, and our dads were getting it from like talk radio in the 80s, like what would your dad's relationship with Twitter be now?
I mean, it would be non-existent, because I think that's such a great question, because yeah. Like where he would get his information, like he read the newspaper sure. every morning, you know, basically cover to cover.
Okay.
So that's where he got his primary news. That was his primary news source. He also went to church on Sunday morning.
Yeah.
And we went to some churches that would have gotten political when it mattered, sure. you know, especially when it came to, you know, pro-life issues and things of that nature. And then and he went to a men's Bible study, like a midweek men's Bible study. So I was never with him, you know, during those things. But so I'm trying to think of like that primarily would have been where he had both like information and discourse
yeah.
happening in his life. And so yeah, I think in entertainment for him was baseball. So Major League Baseball. Oh, so God, I mean that was so he wasn't, and he didn't watch the news. That.
Everything about him makes me wish we could hang out. That just like he goes to church, he goes to Bible study, he works hard, he reads the newspaper, and he watches baseball. I'm like, oh man, I like this guy.
I feel like 80% of Twitter would be better if they just tried more baseball. You know,
if they were just like John F.
Tweet less, just watch like John more F. baseball. Martin. You know,
but like his major, he had no theological issues.
Yeah.
He never brought a theological issue like to the table at the house.
Yeah.
So there was, he just, you know, I mean, maybe to a fault, he just believed everything our pastor told him, because that was the guy with the seminary degree. Right. Sure. So, I mean, again, there's issues with that too.
Yeah.
But he just believed that. And the only thing I think he was ever really passionate about was, you know, he was obviously really opposed to like, you know, immorality and how that was infiltrating television and movies and, you know, the minds of his kids, obviously.
Yeah.
And I think the only other thing was that obviously he was going to be a small government guy, in the sense that, you know, he didn't want to pay a lot of taxes like everybody feels, you know, sure. like, you know, all that stuff. So like that was it. Like yeah. that was
oh, you mean back when Republicans went, you know? Were like an actual political party who talked about issues of government. That
whoa,
era.
Whoa, 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 whoa.
I'm kidding.
I have no idea. I don't even, sure, I guess.
Well, simply saying we've completely lost the plot, and our political parties, like when you say small government, that's the thing your dad was passionate about. I don't hear anybody who's like, that's the thing that they're pounding the table over anymore.
Yeah.
And when I say passionate, I mean, every once in a while seven times a day, he would call somebody a pinko commie that was just trying to take all of his money. I mean, that's really all of it. That's really all it was.
Yeah.
It didn't go a lot deeper than that, to be quite honest.
Let me.
Interesting.
Yeah. Let me ask you guys this. No, that's good. Was it more so like your dad calling somebody a pinko commie in the 80s? Like, I hear you tell that story, and I equate it with like similar experiences of growing up in the 80s. And it seems like in my backward viewing lens, it seems more innocent and more almost like charming and quaint. Whereas what's going on now seems nefarious and like evil, I guess, at a very deep level, because I see it like eating away at people's contentment and joy and souls and personas in a way that's. Yeah. That's
well, here's what it was too.
Yeah,
that's a great question.
I'm rambling.
So I would say it like this. Like, again, this doesn't necessarily mean it's better. It was different.
Yeah.
So basically, I think back then, like if you're talking about John F. Martin, his anger could be compartmentalized more easily
than
it
big.
Is now.
Yeah.
So in other words, like he would have a couple of things that he was passionate about, and he would be passionate about it for 2 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
And then he didn't have this device or this medium or this platform to stay angry about it for the next 24, 48,
sure.
you know, I don't, that's yeah. as far as I know how to count
yeah,
hours,
yeah, yeah.
you know? So it wasn't this perpetual thing where he was constantly being tempted to be just just, you know, fed up and eye-rolly and grumpy and angry about like everything that was going on in the world. And that's our temptation now. And, you know, so it really was more simple times, you know, just for, because of what was lacking, what we didn't have available to it.
Yeah. Yeah. No, that's a great point. So, I mean, is anyone talking about Twitter as like a temptation to sin? You know what I mean?
100%.
It seems to me that it is.
Dude.
But
100%.
I don't hear anyone talking about it in that way, you know?
Well, I mean, dudes that are like, I mean, honestly, like I have, so we have, Piper and I probably have shared friends in this where they'll, I know we make fun of guys when they say, hey, I'm taking a Twitter break,
sure.
You know, they announce it. So we made jokes about that. But I've talked to people that have done that, and whether they announce it or not, they have told me, I just need to get away from this for a few months.
Yeah.
Because it's just doing bad things for me, and it's causing me to be angry. It's causing me to sin,
yeah.
is what they're saying.
Yeah.
And so they make those steps, and they're not saying, hey, realistically, I'm never getting back into it. I mean, they know they're probably going to dive back into it. But for a moment, they want to sort of cleanse their system and get it out of their system.
Yeah. Interesting.
Yeah, I mean, people do talk about it that way personally.
Okay.
Right. I have a friend named Chris Martin, who's one of the most – he's probably early 30s. He just came out with a book on essentially Christianity and social media, but like from a deep dive, how is social media shaping us? That kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. Really thoughtful guy, really understands kind of he's the kind of guy who, when Facebook releases papers, he summarizes them for normal people to be like, this is what they're actually saying they're doing to your brain, that kind of stuff. Mm-hmm. And so he's definitely looking at it and going, he would say social media is not a moral neutral. You know, we kind of treat it as like a blank piece of paper. And then what you put on the paper defines morality or not. You know, that's kind of been my approach. And he's like, it's not a moral neutral because there's people running it with agendas. And seeking to shape things and the way that it's shaping everything from elections to souls and stuff like that.
Yeah.
I don't think that's in the public consciousness. I think there are thoughtful people who are coming at it that way. And then there's what Ronnie said, the personal side where people are coming at it and and saying it's having an ill effect on me personally, so I need to step away. Most of the time when I see that, I see it more like when people, you know, they do like the dry January thing. Mm-hmm. I'm gonna not drink in January for self-control, for help, just to kind of be like, you know, I have control over this thing. It doesn't have control over me. And I think that's probably good, but I don't know how to approach that question from a, you know, kind of the sweeping, is it more temptation or more good? Because I do think somebody like Ronnie or me can use it in a way and probably walk away from it in a way where there is a significant net gain. There's a net gain in relationships made, you know, the connections made, information gained. We can kind of curate our feeds so that the negativity lives elsewhere. But I don't think that's true for a huge chunk of the users, maybe not the majority. I would venture to say that cumulatively speaking, the world would be a better place if social media didn't exist.
Yeah.
But also, whatever, that ship has sailed.
Sailed forever.
Yeah, I mean, sailed, hit the iceberg, sunk to the bottom of the sea, and they built a new and better one. Like, here we are. It's a whole part of our reality. And so there's just something about, okay, if it's here, there for some people it's good to avoid it.
Yeah.
But it's also it is a genuine space that Christians need to inhabit well. And right now, I don't think we do. I think some people try to, and a lot of people just kind of cave to the temptation of being sucked in and jerks.
It's like managing your alcohol intake.
Yeah.
Some people can have a drink. Some people, you know, they just don't have it in them to moderate that, so they have to abstain altogether. You know, I mean, man, it's across the
board. Yeah, which is wisdom. Like if you know that about yourself and you're like, yeah, I don't touch the stuff, that's wise. And for those people like Ted, every time you know, we talk about you not being on Twitter, I poke fun, but at the same time, I'm like, Ted knew himself well enough to know that Twitter would have a costly effect on his soul.
Yeah.
I think that's fleeing temptation. That's a good thing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, this has been good. This has been really like interesting to me, and it's helpful for me to check in on it from time to time. Just to like, gauge people's thoughts on it. And yeah, it was really interesting. I mean, it to your friend's point about it not being a moral neutral, I just think it's something that people view as a thing that they have a limitless capacity for, when in reality, we should probably think of it like running. Like, we can't, you can't go outside and run for like 100 hours in a row, right? You know, some of us could run for 20 minutes and that would be it, you know, and then we would have to rest. But I think you get people like living their lives on it and just getting so many reps in with it that it becomes, it begins to shape reality in a way that isn't real. And that I think is probably almost always a net negative, even if it's shaping reality in ways that feel fun or stimulating or whatever.
Well, because it's idol. I mean, really, you know, it's, we make idols out of everything, and there's an idolatry
aspect,
know, obviously
to
component to this that is just, it's like it's impossible to ignore. And, you know, we have to guard against that.
Yeah.
We have to guard against that in every facet of our life. Mm-hmm. It's not like social media just feels exaggerated right now. Mm-hmm. But in that sense, there's all these other subtle things that become major idols in our lives that we dismiss or we miss.
Yeah.
And social media is just more glaring.
Yeah.
But it's almost because it's so glaring and it's so a part of our day-to-day lives that we will tend to dismiss it. We're not going to miss it. It's right there.
Yeah.
But we're going to tend to dismiss it as being able to see that in reality, you know, if it's tempting us to be angry, to be, you know, to you know, want to build platforms, to want to, you know, we like those hits because it gives us some level of affirmation. I mean, we're really talking about idolatry at this point.
No, you're right.
It's interesting.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
For one follow up, quick comment.
Yeah.
So Chris Martin, who I just mentioned, just released a book. It's called Terms of Service: The Real Cost of Social Media. And
it looks great.
I would recommend it to any listener who just wants to kind of think carefully through this stuff. Idolatry issues, the effect of social media on us, the good and the bad of it. He's not berating anybody, but rather kind of a wise guide to how do we think through this stuff. So again, Terms of Service, just released. I would recommend it to anybody who's like, I want to be careful with social media and be wise, but not just sort of be the black and white in or out person.
Yeah, no.
Little free promo there for Chris Martini.
Dude, shout out Chris Martini and Huffy Bicycles, our two sponsors for this morning's program. Huffy executives, if you're listening, how would you like to be a Huffy executive, baby?
Oh,
wouldn't that
I
be
can't
incredible?
Even think.
Yeah.
I can't even. I mean, I was going to say, like, if Huffy could sponsor us, I can't even. Oh, no. Huffy bikes are still alive and well. I'm looking at it right now.
Dude, that's so good to hear. Can you imagine a brand new Huffy bike on each of our doorsteps in the next?
Oh, my goodness.
You know,
you're describing a dream.
Can you imagine if somebody came out with a brand now called Huffy bikes? People would be like, what is this? A shot at fat people? You know, like, this is the sound they make when they're on the bike, you know, and the digital coach is screaming at them.
It was a simpler time.
Huffy would never fly.
It was a simpler time,
wasn't it, baby?
It's back when you rode a Huffy because your dad couldn't afford a Schwinn. It was that simple,
dude. Yeah, everybody in my town rode Huffies. It wasn't even a big deal. Boys, we've done what we always do on this program, in that we've waxed nostalgic about our new sponsor, Huffy Bicycles USA, and we've talked some social media, which was helpful and productive. I forget what I was going to say. Oh, shout out Dwell Bible, our actual sponsor for the program. And until next time.
The Happy Rant is brought to you by Resonate Recordings. If you go to resonaterecordings.com, you can see the full range of services they offer. So if you're considering starting a podcast, they are the ones we recommend going with. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see their prices, to connect with them and ask any questions, and to see what they can do to help you launch, edit, master, and improve your podcast. Again, go to resonaterecordings.com to see what they can do to help you launch and improve your podcast.
Hey everybody, I'm Dale.
And I'm Tamara.
And we're hosts of the Kynos Project podcast. where we help you tackle ancient Christian truths in everyday settings.
The word kainos means new, and that's exactly what we want to do on our podcast, bring something new from what is old in our faith.
And on this show, you might hear us explore topics like what the Bible has to say about student loan forgiveness, discuss how the Satanic Temple affects our view of religious liberty in America, or even question why is it that so many people are having rapture anxiety.
To learn more about the podcast, go to lifeaudio.com.